Chapter 12. Tok sat on a chair that was too small for him, glanced over at Archie McClellan, and contemplated the fact that he was probably going to have to eat him. Morally, Tok had no problem with this. Tok, like all Nagach his age, was on his true, the culturally mandated moral journey in which young Nagach endeavor to experience as many aspects of existence as possible, including the unseemly. This last category could reasonably be expected to include consuming members of other sentient species. During the Ftru, a Nagach, like any member of the CC, would be legally liable for his or her actions, so Tok would be on the hook for murder if he were caught. But as a matter of sin, Tok was in the clear. Nagach experiencing the Ftru were considered blameless, on the rationale that one of the objects of the journey was to experience sin and thus better understand it. Unless Tok decided to end it early and return to the fold, he had roughly 14 months left on his Ftru. After that point, eating humans would be a definite mark against his soul. At the moment, however, he could eat his way through an entire schoolyard with nary a theological burp. So morals weren't the issues. Instead, Tok was focused on the practical matters of eating humans, namely that they tended to come with a number of indigestible components, like watches and communicators and plastic zippers and metal shoe bits, and occasionally some things that you simply couldn't know about until after you've eaten someone. That sheep rancher, for example, had some metal pins and screws in him. Acuna told him that some humans had broken bones screwed back into place rather than fixed up by a quick heal session. It was a cost thing. All Tok knew was that they poked uncomfortably. Like every other indigestible item of human accoutrement, Tok eventually had to spit them out, otherwise they'd just pile up in his digestive sac, and Tok would jangle when he walked and feel them clanging together inside of him. Tok hated that. Optimally, Tok thought, he'd be able to strip a human out of his stuff before ingesting them, but Tok realized that a situation like that probably wasn't going to happen. The whole advantage Tok had in dealing with humans was the element of surprise. No human being actually ever expected to be eaten. Ridding them of their clothes and personal objects would pretty much telegraph Tok's intentions. He had to accept the occasional watch and leg screw as an occupational hazard. With that in mind, Tok was eyeing McClellan to see how much indigestible crap the human might have with him. Tok was pleased to see that the human appeared to be wearing no jewelry, save for a watch, and especially no earrings, which were small and pointy and difficult for Tok to remove afterward. The human's clothes likewise appeared fine. Digesting humans had made Tok something of a connoisseur of human clothing fabrics, and he could tell by the hang and crumple of Archie's clothes that they were primarily natural fibers rather than artificial. That meant less of a lump of plastic fibers a day down the line. Then there was that thing Archie had in his hand, which he'd been looking at off and on since Acuna brought him back and told Tok to watch him. "Hey," Tok said, his first words to Archie since he was dragged back into the room. "What is that in your hand?" Archie looked up. "It's a book," he said. "What is it made out of?" Tok asked. Archie held it up so Tok could see it. "Plastic. You hold it in your hand and the heat from your body powers the optical imager to project the pages." "So, plastic," said Tok. He could handle a little bit of plastic. "Yeah," Archie said, and went back to his reading. After several minutes, Tok's now awakened curiosity got the better of him. "What's the book about?" he asked. "It's a book of poems," Archie said, not looking up. "What kind of poems?" Tok asked. Now Archie looked up. "You actually care?" he said. "I'm just as bored as you are," Tok said. "They're prophetic poems," Archie said. "They tell the future?" Tok asked. "Sort of," Archie said. "It's more like they suggest things that could happen, and it's up to us to decide what to do about it." "Why are you reading them?" Tok asked. "Because I'm trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do next," Archie said, turning back to his book. Tok was taken aback. "You're on a religious quest?" he asked Archie. Archie shrugged. "I suppose I am," he said. Almost instantly, Tok was overcome with a rush of affection for this little human. The Ftru was a difficult passage for any young Nagach. The Nagach were a people who thrived on family and tradition. Tossing young Nagakhs out to experience the universe was a paradoxically isolating experience for most of them and made them yearn to return to their homes and rituals, a fact not in the least lost on older Nagakh. Tok had been on Earth for a better part of 2 years. He'd come there because it was the planet that had been randomly selected for him to visit 2 Nagakh years prior, just enough time to learn to read and speak English. He'd been given a transport ticket and a small stipend and told not to return until his FTRU was completed. In that time, Tok had largely consorted with scumbags. His stipend was small, and his visa was tourist, and being unencumbered by the worries of sin, he had no qualms about working under the table for questionable people and their even more questionable aims. However, it did leave him with a general perception that humans were spiritually bereft beings. Tok understood that Earth was positively littered with houses of worship, and that people were always claiming that their god of choice wanted them to do one thing or another. But in his personal experience, the only time he heard people invoke their deity was when Tok was about to beat the hell out of them or turn them into a snack. And even then, more than half the time, they invoked defecation instead. Tok found that inexplicable. And thus, Archie McClellan became the first human Tok had met who actually appeared to have a religious component to his personality. Or at the very least, a religious component not motivated entirely by fear of imminent injury or death. Meeting someone with a religious impulse activated a dormant section of Tok's personality, very much like a turned-on faucet expands a desiccated sponge. Tok advanced on Archie enthusiastically. Archie, quite understandably, flinched.
"Tell me about your quest," Tok said.
"What?" Archie said.
"Your quest," Tok said. "I am on a religious quest also."
Archie looked at Tok skeptically. "But you're doing this," he said, sweeping his arm about.
"So are you," Tok said.
Archie blinked.
Tok had a point there.
Archie glanced down at his book, which had turned its optically generated page thanks to his flinch, and his eye caught the poem there. "Lo, the screw turns, yet the direction is not set. Those who teach may let learn, and those who learn, teach.
When we pass beyond, what is left but what we tell?
We may yet reach from beyond to turn the screw once more." Among the scholars of the church, who liked to use study of the stanzas as an excuse for barbecues and the consumption of beer, this was one of the minor exhortation stanzas, encouraging church members to share information with each other so that church aims could be accomplished further down the line. Direct, simple, and uncomplicated, like the stanzas encouraging good hygiene and flossing, which were generally followed, and the avoidance of fatty foods, and, ironically, for the alcoholic dwellin', too much imbibing, which, given the beer-fueled cookouts, were not. These were generally regarded as the least interesting of the prophetic poems, for much the same reasons as the layout of dietary laws in the Pentateuch failed to set afire Jewish and Christian theologians. Right here, and right now, however, Archie McClellan felt his eyes bulge and the empathist impulse, that creepy feeling that Dwellin really did unintentionally connect with something larger, whether he meant to or not, flared in his chest like heartburn. Archie was already clearly and sickly aware that he was a dead man walking. After about the 30th time Acuna pressed that vending machine button, Archie reconciled himself to the idea that the rest of his life would be counted in hours, and that at the end of it, he was likely to be a snack for the monstrous alien that was now asking him about his religion. And yet here was a fragmentary bit of wisdom, scrawled by a consumptive hack decades back, but even so, telling him that even when he was gone, there was still work to be done. Archie looked back up at Tok, who was standing there, still rather too close for Archie's comfort zone.
"Can I ask you a question?" Archie said.
"Yes," Tok said. "Aren't you going to have to kill me soon?" Archie said. "Isn't that what you're watching me for?"
"I think so," Tok said.
"And you're going to do it," Archie said. "If Acuna walks through the door right now and says, 'Eat him,' you're going to do it."
"Probably," Tok said.
"And yet you suddenly want to be my friend," Archie said. "Doesn't that strike you as, I don't know, kind of strange?"
"No," Tok said. "If I had known about your religious quest earlier, I would have wanted to know about it then, too." If you knew about it earlier, it would have gotten me killed, Archie said.
It's going to get you killed now, Tok said.
Archie opened his mouth and then closed it. I have no good argument against that, he said.
So you'll tell me about your quest? Tok said.
I think I will, Archie said, and waved his hand over the optical control that increased the size of the book page large enough for the both of them to read. Have you read this? Jean Schroeder waved an old-fashioned paper book of Dwellin's prophecies at Rod Acuna. No, Acuna said. He was bored. Most religious books are incompatible with my line of work. It's completely ridiculous, Schroeder said. It's like Nostradamus, hungover and in free verse. Complete bullshit, and they made a religion out of it anyway. A well-off religion, I might add. What do you want me to do with the geek? Acuna said. I want you to get rid of him, of course, Schroeder said. I know who he works for, and I don't have any questions for him. You can add him to that other pile you have in your trunk. That one expired where you're sitting, incidentally. Acuna shifted in his chair and looked down at the rug on the floor, which featured a large, dark blotch. You might want to get rid of the incriminating bloodstain, he said. In a few days, I'm going to be running this joint, by which I mean the entire planet, Schroeder said. I'm not worried about a bloodstain. Besides, we're leaving in about 3 hours. Narf has generously invited you and me and your flunky to come with him to Nidu for his coronation ceremony. Actually, he's invited me, but it makes sense for you and your flunky to get off planet too, so you're coming along for the ride. And you'll even be able to pack your guns, since we'll be going on an official Nidu diplomatic vessel. Diplomatic immunity is a delightful thing. What about Creek and the woman? Acuna said. I sent you the information on where they are. How are we going to get them? We aren't going to get them, Schroeder said. The Nidu military are. The ship our friends are on just happens to make a stop at Chog Fun, which is a Nidu colony. The local military will pick them up there. The military will hand them over to Narf, whose ship will make a stop at Chog Fun for that purpose before heading on to Nidu. The heir apparent seems to trust Narf, but by the time Narf gets to Nidu, the ritual will have been open to other clans. Narf is going to waltz his way right to the throne. That's really fascinating, Acuna said, but I couldn't possibly give a shit. What I want is Creek. Schroeder grinned.
Pissed off at being beat up, Rod?
Mildly, Acuna growled. A broken wrist, a busted nose, and then getting the shit kicked out of me for a second time in one night because I went after him. Yeah, I'm a tad pissed. Once you have the girl, you're not going to need him anymore. I want you to give him to me. You're going to have your walking garbage disposal take care of him when you're done, I assume? Schroeder said. No, Acuna said. Tok likes his food alive and in one piece. That's how he's going to get the geek. Creek's not going to be that lucky. Creek followed the crew member who had retrieved him up the stairs and onto the bridge of the Neverland and was presented to Captain Lehane, who was conferring with his navigator. Mr. Toshima, Lehane said, shaking his hand. Glad you could come up for a visit. Thanks, Creek said. One doesn't usually turn down an invitation by the captain to visit the bridge of a starship. No, I guess one wouldn't, Lehane said. And while I'm flattered and fascinated, Creek said, I am wondering why I was extended such an invitation. Ned Leff informed me that you had agreed to fill in for our ceremony, but that your luggage and uniform had been left behind, so I told him I'd help you out, Lehane said. I'm in the wrong branch of the service, but some of my officers served in infantry. So I thought I'd have you drop by so I could size you up, as it were. See from which of my officers you might borrow some duds. Here I am, Creek said. Indeed, said Lehane. Sam tells me you were with the 12th Infantry, 6th Battalion. I was, Creek said. That's a hell of a thing, Lehane said. Not many of you made it back in one piece. No, Creek agreed. No, not many of us did. Do you still keep in touch with any of them? Lehane asked. I knew Colonel Van Doren pretty well once he left the service. Creek furrowed his brow. I keep in touch with a couple, he said.
Who did you say you knew?
Colonel Van Doren, Lehane said. Jim Van Doren. I don't think I knew him, Creek said. Our colonel was Jack Medina. Tough old son of a gun. Held off rebels with his sidearm. That's right, Lehane said. Sorry, got my battalions mixed up. No problem, Creek said. Brennan, Lehane said. One of the bridge crew peeled off from his station and came to the captain. You were in infantry, he said. Yes, sir, Brennan said. Lehane looked at Brennan and Creek together.
Close enough, Lehane said. You might need a minor alteration on the pants. I'll have the ship's seamstress come round to your cabin. Brennan, would you be so kind as to lend Mr. Toshima here your dress uniform? Anything for a survivor of the Sixth, Brennan said, saluted Creek, and sat back down. That's service, Creek said. Remind me to note that on the rating slip at the end of the tour. The crew members who served know all about you being on the ship, Lehane said. That sounds ominous, Creek said. Lehane smiled. I doubt that, he said. Let's just say that you're likely to find a substantial number of your drinks on the house. Thanks, but I prefer to pay, Creek said. All the other guys here fought in the same battle I did. I was hoping you might say something like that, Lehane said. It's good character. Have you been enjoying your trip so far? We have, Creek said. My fiancé and I just got back from visiting Caledonia. New Edinburgh is absolutely beautiful. Debbie is thrilled our luggage got lost because it's giving her an excuse to stock up. Creek wasn't entirely sure Robin would be thrilled at the picture he was painting of her as Debbie, but there was no reason to stick too close to the real-life script. Caledonia is beautiful, Lehane agreed. A lot of tourists are disappointed because New Edinburgh isn't tropically located, but it's my favorite stop on our itinerary. It's sad that we have to cut short our stay here, and at Bryn, too, in order to get Chogfoon into the schedule. We only have a day at each, and just one day at Chogfoon as well, although that doesn't bother me terribly. You don't sound very excited about Chogfoon, Creek said. I'm not, Lehane admitted, in a rush that felt as if he were allowing a dark secret to be pulled out into the open. It's a terrible place, you know. Bad things happen to us, bad things happen to the rebels, and in both cases, the Nidu were to blame. They're still there, of course. The idea of taking one of our spaceships back into that space knots my gut. And yet Ned says you lobbied hard for the Neverland to take these men to Chogfoon, Creek said. I did, Lehane said. If anyone's going to bring these guys back into hell, even for a vacation, it should be someone who's been there before, and who knows the way back out again. I think I like you, Captain Lehane, Creek said. Feelings mutual, Mr. Toshima, Lehane said. You're a survivor of the Sixth. I imagine you know what it's like to take men out of hell. I do, Creek said. Some of them, anyway. Brian let his consciousness float before the informal edifice that was the Church of the Evolved Lambs computer network and tried to figure out the best way to break in. Earlier in the day, Brian had noted with satisfaction that his older brother had swatted back the Nidu attempt to reclassify Robin Baker as property and rammed the ruling right down their lizardly throats. Brian had burst with fraternal pride as he read the judge's ruling. Ben had always been the smart one in the family and had a special knack for sneaking up behind people in an intellectual sense and then whacking them in the skull, which is exactly what had happened here. But Brian didn't think the ruling was close to the end of it. People who were happy to argue that a human has as many rights as an alarm clock were not likely to be stopped by a judge. They'd be after Robin again soon enough, and Harry along with her. Brian felt that it was his mission to find out how, stop it if he could, or at least inform Harry about what to expect. By dint of Harry's security clearance, Brian knew everything the UNE knew about the situation, which was not enough to help him extrapolate what the Nidu would do next. There were two other players who had information Brian didn't have and that he needed, the Nidu government itself and the Church of the Evolved Lamb, who, through Archie McClellan, had been keeping tabs on the entire situation. Brian read up on both, which in this case meant accessing the complete information about both in his databanks, a process which took a couple of seconds. He was not entirely surprised to find two significant points of connection between the Nidu government and the Church. The first was that the android's dream sheep was a breed of sheep designed by the Church, or, more accurately, its genetics labs, which were part of the overall Haider-Ross corporate structure, for the Nidu government at the behest of the UNE government. Even more accurately, it had been designed for the Off-Gitog clan prior to their challenge for the Nidu throne years back. This was an interesting bit of trivia. It showed the UNE had placed their bets on the succession long before it actually went down. Designing an entirely new breed of sheep took time. The second is that the construction of the Nidu computer network currently in use had been contracted out to the UNE, the Off-Gitog clan's way of scratching the back of those who had scratched theirs. The UNE, in return, subcontracted the job to several companies, two-thirds of whom, including the managing subcontractor Ligasen, were companies within the overall Haider-Ross corporate umbrella. The specifics of the computer system were not available. Of course, they were Nidhu state secrets. But the general gist of the computer system was that it allowed the Nidhu Feihen complete access to and control of every network-enabled computer and application in Nidhu space. And they were all network-enabled. By Nidhu law, if it had a processor, it had to be attached to the network. Lesser, but still Orwellian levels of access were provided by the Feihen to other Nidhu higher-ups, who, it goes without saying, were entirely loyal to the Feihen. This was all in the service of total centralized control. In this technologically centered age, a rebellion that relied on paper was not a rebellion that would get very far. There was no way for Brian to access the Nidhu computer network directly. From Earth, there were only two points of entry. The first was at the Nidhu embassy, where the Nidhu network-enabled computers and appliances were intentionally incompatible with Earth standard technology and used wired rather than wireless connections. Short of Brian physically breaking into the Nidhu embassy and using Nidhu input devices to access the network, unlikely, as Brian was lamentably short of physicality at the moment, he was out in the cold. On the other hand, Ligasen maintained a connection to the Nidhu network as part of its continuing maintenance contract with the Nidhu government. Ligasen, a subsidiary of Hader Ross, controlled by the Church of the Evolved Lamb. All the more reason, Brian thought, to break into the church's network. Brian was actually entirely filled with admiration for the church. He'd read Dwellin's prophecies, and unlike the UNE and Nidhu governments, who apparently saw only the Hader Ross corporate structure and not the religious entity behind it, Brian had come to the conclusion that the church was working to hasten the end times hinted at in its own prophecies, and had well and truly maneuvered the governments of two planets to that end. Brian idly wondered what would happen if, indeed, the church managed to reach its goal and bring forth the evolved lamb. He doubted very seriously that the church would disband. All of this was immaterial, however, to the salient point of entering the network and seeing what he could see regarding Robin, Harry, and the Nidhu's plans for them. No time like the present, Brian thought, and with that, extended himself into every conceivable nook and cranny of the church's system, looking for a keyhole in. This was not the smartest way Brian should have been doing his search. He'd have probably been better off beginning with a non-invasive survey of the system, wandering through the public areas to get an idea where to start poking around without signaling the network it was under a massive attack. But Brian considered that sort of slow-paced examination to be a luxury Robin and Harry couldn't afford at the moment. Anyway, he thought of himself as an Alexander type, cutting the Gordian knot in half, while more cautious types fiddled with the rope end, futilely trying to figure out where to begin untying. Brian had no doubt he was ringing alarm bells across the entire church network. But was he not the world's first intelligent agent? He'd either be in the system momentarily, or he'd simply outthink and outmaneuver the security measures. Ah, here we go. Someone left an easily crackable programming backdoor at Roivo, a small Hader Ross subsidiary that made replacement parts for aging sewers. Not an especially romantic corner of the church's empire, to be sure. Brian jammed some password repeater code into the door and cycled it through. 3 seconds and a mere 254,229 password attempts later, he was in. Piece of cake. The lights went out. Metaphorically, of course. Brian, being previously human and consciously regarding himself as still thus, had created a perceptual system to help him relate to the information he was processing. But however you want to slice it, 2 cycles previously, Brian had been fully perceptually aware of his surroundings and able to move freely. Now, he perceived nothing except his own thoughts, which were, "What the fuck?" "Hello," said a woman's voice, warm but with a sharp edge. "And what do we have here?" Then it went away for a perceptually indefinite period of time. Then it came back. "You're very interesting," it said. "I'm going to take you apart and find out what makes you tick. I hope you don't mind. I should be able to put you back together when I'm done. No promises, though. Also, given what I can see of your perceptual structure, this is going to hurt." Brian felt himself being torn apart almost immediately thereafter. His first reaction was something akin to amazement. He hadn't been aware his perceptual metaphor had included an equivalent to pain. And now that he was aware that it did, he wondered what the fuck he was thinking of, or not thinking of, to be more accurate about it, when he added it in. His second reaction was to scream his head off and wonder if, for the second time in his life, he might be dying.
Radakuna opened the door to his apartment to find Archie McClellan and Tok huddled together reading a book.
"What the fuck are you doing?" Acuna yelled at Tok.
"We were just reading a book," Tok said. "Just passing time."
"Just passing time? Holy Christ," Acuna said. "What is this, kindergarten? If I came back in an hour, would you be having milk and cookies and settling down for a nap?"
Tok raised his paw, as if to make another point.
"Shut up," Acuna said. "You and I are leaving here in an hour. I'm going to go pack some things. When I come back out, I want your little reading buddy taken care of. Do you understand me?"
"I understand you," Tok said.
"Good," Acuna said. He went off into a back room. Archie set the book down on the table. It flickered off as he did so. Tok stood up, and so did Archie, supporting himself on the table and taking care not to put weight on his injured leg. They had a moment of uncomfortable silence.
"So," Tok said, finally.
"Yeah," Archie said. "So this is the part where you kill me and eat me."
"I guess so," Tok said. "Although, it's the other way around."
"Oh," Archie said. "That's good to know, I guess." Tok reached over and put his monstrous paw on Archie's shoulder.
"I'm really sorry, Archie. I don't see any way around this."
Archie smiled. "It's all right, Tok. This is going to sound weird, so bear with me when I say this. But I'm glad it's you doing this and not him. The last few hours have been unexpected. I think that's the way to say it. I'm glad I got to know you."
"I'm glad I got to know you too," Tok said.
More than glad, really. In the space of a few hours, Tok was certain that he had made his first, best, and only human friend, as he sat there and listened to Archie explain the history of the Church of the Evolved Lamb, the prophecies and his own role in them, and even hinted that Tok himself might have a role to play.
"Look at these," Archie had said, pointing to a series of poems in which the Evolved Lamb gained a protector from an unexpected source, a series of poems, unbeknownst to church members, inspired directly from a television soap opera Dwellin had running in the background at the time. "Who's to say that this protector might not be you?"
It was a profoundly moving thought for Tok, the idea that he might be called upon in some small way to finish the mission of his newfound friend.
"I'm going to miss you," Tok said to Archie.
"Thanks," Archie said. He picked up his book and handed it to Tok. "Look, I want you to have this," he said. "Read it and think about it, especially in the next few days, okay? Important stuff is happening, and we're all a part of it, so read about it."
"I will," Tok said, taking it. "I promise."
"Do me a favor," Archie said. "Sometime in all of this, you might meet a church member named Sam Berlant. We're a couple. Tell Sam I send my love. And I'm sorry I didn't get to the end of this."
"I'll do what I can," Tok promised.
"All right," Archie said. "What do I do now?"
"Just stand there," Tok said. "Although there is one thing."
"What?" Archie said.
"Could you take off your watch?" Tok asked. "I can't digest that."
Archie took off his watch and set it down on the table.
"Ready?"
Tok said.
"Ready," Archie said.
"Goodbye, Tok."
"Goodbye, Archie," Tok said,
threw himself open, and consumed his friend as quickly as he could. Once inside him, Tok could feel Archie struggling not to move or to panic. Tok thought that was pretty classy. In a few minutes, it was over. Tok looked at the book in his massive paw, figured out how to activate it, and sat down to read until Acuna was ready to leave.